Chapter 37. 5 days later. Keelan Manor, Kernford. Pain was College Keelan's constant companion. Alcohol was the only anesthetic the medicans prescribed for the stump of his leg. He ignored the medicans' advice. The pain from his leg helped dull the pain from Arnett's death. The funeral ceremony had been held in St. Thomas Cathedral in Kernford 3 days previously, with Abbot Walcott leading the congregation and giving one of several eulogies. Mara spoke for the family and broke down several times before gathering herself and continuing. No one paid attention to her tears, because many in the audience cried along with her. Of the four Keelan daughters, Arnett had been most favored by the people who knew her. Mara garnered respect, married fondness, and Sinwin exasperation. But it was Arnett who drew love to herself simply by her presence. As sorrowful as the funeral was, it faded under the blazing anger of Keelanders from all corners of the province. It was bad enough that the Nathani had crippled their hetman. But to kill Arnett and threaten Aeneas, the first grandchild, lit a fire within the people that would have shaken the Nathani had they witnessed the consequences of the attack. Nowhere did the fire rage more than within the Keelan family. Yet while College and Mara let their fury vent, Breda Keelan was the family rock. She tended both her husband and Sinwin, whose head was half-sheathed in a bandage covering her almost severed cheek. The medicans said Balwas's quick action of holding the flap of flesh back in place had greatly increased the chances the tissue would live and heal. Yet they had no doubt Sinwin would bear a great scar, an expectation not yet apparent to Sinwin, as she dealt with the pains of her wound and the loss of her sister. No one had seen Breda sleep since the attack, though she must have, because no one could stay awake for 5 days and still function. When Mara finally forced her mother to get some needed sleep, Mara sat with her father. By unspoken agreement, they didn't talk of Arnett. "Do you think we've done the right thing, father? Attacking Iwal and threatening the Nathani? All the action is so far from communication. We can only imagine what's happened." "I hope we did, Mara. It seemed so simple a decision at the time. The last several days, I keep asking myself whether I approved out of anger rather than rational reasoning." "The plan was already in place as one of the contingencies," Mara reminded him. "Hypothetical situations on paper are not the same as sending men out to fight. Even if everything works as we planned, men will be killed. By God's grace, we pray it's not too many. Still, however many it is will weigh on me. Dennis and our reaction force are the most vulnerable. They're going straight at the Nathani, whereas Hetman Stent is only feigning to keep the Iwali's attention. Dennis needs to remember their objective is not to fight battles, only to do enough damage that the Nathani and Iwali's are circumspect about future aggressions." "Do we have any idea who the new Iwal Hetman is? Or should I say, who the Nathani installed?" asked Mara.
"No idea," College replied. "Almost certainly their dead from Moreland City included other members of the Hetman's family, Boyerman and other leaders. It's not much different from the Moreland clan, who is now giving orders in Moreland, seems to vary daily."
"Speaking of the Iwali's capital," said Mara, "I can't help but wonder if we'll ever see Balwas Preti and Y4 Kales again. I'm still surprised Yosef sent them to do something so dangerous. I'm afraid I can't see how they expect to succeed. I hope that at some point they realize how ludicrous the idea is and turn back before it's too late."
"I agree, Mara. I feel the same. If it weren't for everything else, I'd be mad at Yosef. On the other hand, he's had strange, even insane-sounding ideas before, and they worked out. Maybe this will be another of those times.
Father, I also pray the support group isn't needed to help Dennis's men. And if it is, that Yosef remembers he shouldn't be in the forefront of any fighting.
College didn't tell his daughter that he also worried about his son-in-law. None of the three men tasked with keeping Yosef safe were now with him. Balwas and Kales were somewhere north, hopefully safe and on the way back from their attempt on the Nathani colonel. And Carnegie was recovering from moderate wounds inflicted during the assassination attempt. Although Yosef avowed no interest in being directly involved in fighting, somehow the man managed to contradict that claim every time he was near a fight. Unbeknownst to Kalich, the same worry dogged Mera. She prayed that Yosef understood he was more valuable to the clan than anything he might do in a battle. To divert her thoughts, she changed the subject.
No further word on the attackers, father.
Not since searchers found the camp and wagons we believe they came in. Petter traced the wagons to a stable in Salford. They found the only full-time worker in the stable dead beneath hay in one of the barns. A search of his home discovered enough to establish him as a Nathani agent, probably the one who passed messages to Nathani ships, as you found happening in Abersford. The problem is that it's difficult to see how he could have been the source of information about where I would be on that particular night. It's too much to assume coincidence, so I believe there had to be at least one more spy located in Kernford. I just learned from Vordig that one of the Kernford semaphore station assistants is missing. The one named Esil Havant. He's been to our home, and I assume yours, many times. It would have given him more than enough opportunity to keep track of all of us. I know the man, and never noticed anything about him.
Great God, said Mera. Esil. If he was a Nathani spy, not only did he pay regular visits to our homes, but he must have seen many of the semaphore messages. In fact, he was at our house the same day of the attack.
As for Keelan Manor, said Kulich, I'm afraid I may know one source of his information. Merid was particularly friendly with him. She often fed him when he delivered messages. Just hours before the attack, he was in the kitchen with Merritt. He always seemed too chummy, and I guess I'd say innocuous. It might not have taken much for him to get information from Merritt about our plans to eat at your house that night.
Oh, father, if that's true, you can't ever tell Merritt. She'd never forgive herself for Arnett.
The mention of Arnett brought them both back to a topic they had attempted to avoid. The failure ended their discussion, and Mera sat silently until her father eventually dropped off to sleep. Outside Pomp, Pretty Province. Dennis Vega worried, as he had done the last 2 days, and for the same reason. The Rapid Reaction Force had moved across southern Iwell Province as fast as they could without exhausting the horses. Their pace was a compromise. If they moved too slowly, the Narthani and the Iwellese would learn of their presence and have time to gather forces. If they moved too fast, they'd risk their horses being unable to get them out of danger if they ran into trouble. 3 hours ago, they'd reached a crossroads 6 miles east of the Pretty border. The Pretty town of Pomp lay 10 miles farther. The fork heading north led to the Iwell town of Neath, also 10 miles away. Dennis stood next to his two majors, their horses held by aides. He had to make a choice.
Neath is an easier target, said Major Kildorn. The Erosian had, like Dennis and the other forces' major, Sixworth, been at Moreland City. He'd lost a close cousin at the battle, and had eagerly led the battalion that swept the right flank of the raiding force's path along the coast, and to Dennis's thinking, took excessive pleasure in watching Iwell villages burn.
True, said Sixwith. But our main purpose is to threaten Nathani territory, not the Iwellese.
Dennis thought the Keelan Major more capable than Kildorn, and had left written instructions with aides that if Dennis were killed or incapacitated, Sixwith should assume command. While Yosef argued that such chain of command arrangement should be set in advance, Dennis still struggled to integrate men from different clans and hadn't wanted it to appear that he favored a fellow clansman, a decision he regretted once the force committed to this raid.
Both points are correct, said Dennis. I have sympathy for wanting to see an entire Iwell town the size of Neath burning, especially when we never thought we could do the same to Ponth. Because we know that Arthani have men stationed there, and those might have been reinforced. The Arthani must be aware of us by now, and had to have reacted. Major Kildorn, I'm afraid you'll have to satisfy your urge to burn by destroying whatever villages and farms we find between here and Ponth.
Dennis held up the map in his left hand.
From here on, we leave the poor soil along the Iwell coastal plain and get into good farmland. There will be more people and structures, so more opportunities to raise havoc. The road to Ponth moves farther from the coast, so we'll spread out a little more. Instead of moving a battalion column, we'll move the two battalions abreast, as the artillery stays with me and the support people between battalions. Major Kildorn, spread three of your companies in line aimed at Ponth, and the fourth company screening our flank and a couple of miles to our rear. Major Sixwith, you'll also put three companies in line, with the fourth aggressively scouting ahead. If we run into Nathani soldiers, I want to know as soon as possible. This is going to be a dangerous dance, sirs. Move and burn, while not getting burned ourselves. We have 60 miles to retrace back to Keelan territory, and we don't want to fight our way back.
5 hours later, Dennis faced two more decisions. One was easy and expected, the second more difficult and unexpected. They reached Ponth only to find earthworks thrown up around the town of 3,000, with people still digging as they watched just out of musket range.
Like I told you, Colonel, a pisser, said Sixwith. There's got to be a couple of 100 fighting men in addition to what look like other citizens helping dig. If we attack, we could probably overrun them. But it's not certain, and we'd take casualties.
Getting the seriously wounded back to Keelan would slow us.
We won't attack Ponth. And with what your forward scouts report, there's no time to waste here.
Sixwith's forward scouting company had circled Ponth and pushed a few miles farther into Preti, until they skirmished with what appeared to be Narthani cavalry escorting wagons of infantry headed to Ponth. The company commander gathered his men and withdrew.
Get your men turned around, Major. I think we've done all we can, and it's time to get our asses back to Keelan.
Dennis looked to their right. Nearby was the leftmost company of Major Kildorn's battalion. Beyond, he made out the next company, though he hadn't seen Kildorn for more than an hour. He turned to an aide.
Ride and find Major Kildorn. He's to pull his men together and follow in column. We're moving fast back to Keelan.
20 minutes later, Dennis wasn't sure how fast they'd be moving and cursed the Orosian Major. He waited for the last of Kildorn's company to form up on the road back. When Kildorn arrived, leading a dozen wagons loaded with people, 30 or more horses carrying double, and many of his men with people riding behind them in their saddles.
What the fuck is this, Kildorn?
Dennis roared.
The company came on a slave camp 5 miles north of here. They were being kept in terrible conditions and were used to work all the farms in the area. The company was loading them on wagons when I got there. Kildorn looked alternately defiant and desperate as he talked. We didn't even take them all. Some were in such bad shape, they couldn't have traveled as fast as we need to. A few were too scared to come with us, especially Preddy, who'd been slaves for years. God's curses, Kildorn, said Dennis, sounding desperate himself. Taking them will put all of us in danger. What the hell did you want me to do? Leave them? Even if I wanted to, I doubt the men would have allowed it. These are mainly Kadali, for God's sake! Dennis shook his head, sighed, and guided his horse along the line of wagons. Kildorn was right about the people's condition. All were lean, some nearly emaciated, and many bore scars and bruises. Ages ranged from children no more than 8 years old to gray-haired men and women whose age could have been anywhere from 40 to 80, depending on how long they'd been enslaved and how severe the conditions. Damn, 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 Dennis muttered. He rode back to where Kildorn and other leaders waited. All right. We'll have to take them with us, but they'll have to keep up. I'll have no argument about this. If it comes to a point where we either leave them or risk getting all of us killed, we leave them. Dennis's tone and harsh expression brooked no argument.
Yes, Colonel, said Sixwith.
We understand, and we'll see they don't slow us. Sixwith gave Kildorn a warning look. Kildorn nodded reluctantly. Sixwith, said Dennis. Send a couple of riders hard toward the support camp. Tell them what's happening and that we're bringing... How many of these people are there?
About 300, answered Kildorn.
Have the riders tell them we'll bring in 300 slaves we rescued from the Narthani, and we'll make the best time we can. Inside Ponth. An hour later, Colonel Erkin Ketten entered Ponth soon after his lead cavalry company ensured the town was secure. A Kuyan had charged him with making contact with the Islander raiders, assessing their numbers, and if possible, pursuing.
You don't think that a scout saw more than your company, Captain? Ketten asked the company commander.
I can't be positive, Colonel. My forward men say the Islanders turned and galloped away as soon as they saw those men. The next company was well out of sight, still not through the forest when the Islanders came on us.
Ketten was pleased.
If that's the case, then they don't know exactly how many of us are after them. From what the officer in charge of the Ponthmen says, they have something like 1,000 men. They also saw a few cannon we can assume are cavalry versions, probably 6 to 8 pounders. We have enough men. I'd like to force them to stand and fight, although to do that we have to close with them. Also, General Akuyan plans to divert Brigadier Zalfa's force to land behind them, although the general doesn't know whether Zalfa will be back in time. We know he was supposed to sail from Swaybrook yesterday. We can assume the Islanders came straight across the Iwell coastal plain and will head back the same route toward Keelan. If Zalfa does block their route, we might catch them between us. Major Torvik, I want you to take 2 companies and ride hard to Neath. The Iwellese are supposed to have a standing 100-man force base there. Gather them up and fan out, paralleling the raiders' route, picking up as many more Iwellese as can ride and shoot. Your task is to be on their flank, in case they try to turn north or northeast. Also, if we can get them to stand to fight, you might have opportunities to come at them while they're busy with us or Zalfa. Major Seljunk, keep our militia cavalry organized as best you can. I realize some of them aren't the best horsemen. but don't let them lag.
Pretty City.
I'm afraid your instincts were right, Oaken.
Sadakizer's voice was full of regret, not congratulations.
I know you weren't convinced we should stir the clans up, when the rest of us weren't as worried.
I had reservations, said Akuyan. But it didn't take all of you too long to get me to agree, and still it was my decision. So the consequences rest on me.
Akuyan kicked a trash receptacle across the room. It hit a wall, and paper and various discards exploded in a fountain of debris. He paced to the window, hands clasped behind him, while he regained his composure. The empty harbor held his attention as he went through a mental checklist taught to him many years ago by a captured Fuomi priest. By the 18th step, he felt calm enough to turn back to the assessor.
The raids into Iwell and Predi are obviously not intended to hold territory or win any battles. They just want to show us they can do it. As for Erdalyn, that's either retaliation for striking at the Hetman, or another warning, or both.
The semaphore message of Erdalyn's death had shocked Akuyan. He hadn't liked the man, but Erdalyn was competent. Moreover, to strike right at the heart of the Nathani command structure showed daring and determination. Akuyan couldn't help but imagine his family's house being attacked by assassins. His guard would now be doubled from 8 to 16 men, and 2 men would accompany Rabia and both of their children wherever they went. He also sent a semaphore message to Colonel Metin and Selfsil to be on the alert.
So you think the raid and the strike on Erdalyn were...
what?
Asked his heir.
While I'd prefer to think of them as pure retaliation, I'm afraid I see more behind it.
The clans didn't simply retaliate after our attacks. They prepared all of this well ahead of time.
Think about it. 2 separate 1,000-man raids and going after Erdalyn, all within days of our attacks?
No. It was all in place before we moved.
If I speculated, I'd say they had already considered the possibilities and prepared their attacks in response. No matter what they did or didn't anticipate, the result is the same. Those are the last offensive actions we'll take against the clans until we get reinforcements from Narthon.
Isair sat back in his chair.
I take it you now think it likely the High Command will send more resources?
I'm afraid the only other option I see is abandoning the entire Cadellium objective. If we give the clans too much more time, we might see them seriously coming after us here. Even though we control the seas around the island, they are going to eventually control the land. With their larger numbers and them now making cannon, it's only a matter of time before they judge their position strong enough to come after us. If I was them, I'd start by cutting out Iwell. The clan's already shaken by the losses at Moreland City, and with Erdalyn's death and the damage done by these 2 raids, the clan isn't too far from collapse. Many of the Iwellese could pull back to Predi Province, but we never fooled ourselves that every member of the clan was pleased by Brandor Iwell's alliance with us. It won't surprise me if we hear of Iwellese running to the other clans and asking to be taken in.
Would other clans do that? Asked Hizer. After what Iwell has done?
It would be the smart thing to do,
Akuyan replied.
And the clans are making far too many smart moves for me. But this is all for the future. We need to deal with the now. In Hanslow, what's done is done.
Erdalyn is gone, and Major Jurna seems to have moved quickly.
He reports the city calm,
despite the clan's ability to evidently walk in and kill an Arthani commander. He's acting decisively against the raid. He didn't ask my permission to go after them. Only informed me of his general intent. I've had my eye on him for some time, and this will tell me whether I promote him and leave him in charge, or send in another officer.
What if headquarters doesn't send reinforcements? What then?
Akuyin had anticipated the assessor's question, and despite their good relations, he couldn't be sure if Izair's response to what Akuyin saw as the only alternative.
I believe the High Command is competent enough, and my report's comprehensive enough, that they will see the futility of continuing the mission with what we have. If I'm wrong, then there are hard decisions to make.
Akuyin paused and looked Izair in the eye.
Dangerous decisions. I'm not throwing away the lives of all my men. And Noth knows how many of the 100,000 civilians we have on the island to blindly follow orders I know to be suicidal. In that case, I would order Admiral Culkin to start ferrying the civilians back to Nothon.
His expression didn't change, nor did his tone convey an opinion.
Even if contrary to direct orders?
He asked softly. Akuyin stood on precarious ground. Although it happened rarely, a mission's assessor could, under what he deemed extraordinary circumstances, relieve a commander. Both men knew they danced around a fire pit. Akuyin knew Izair could remove him from command, and Izair knew how respected Akuyin was among all the men. Would Izair act against Akuyin? Would Akuyin arrange a fatal accident before Izair could publicly remove Akuyin? Izair could, theoretically, rule that the High Command was not fully aware of the situation on Cadellium and could support Akuyin, though that itself would be a move with unpredictable consequences. So many unknowns.